Hello there, and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. We're in the middle of our series on the book of Joshua, where we've been talking about the problems with this book. And today we'll be talking about the third problem of Joshua, as discussed in Joshua chapter 7. So Joshua is the most problematic book in the Hebrew Bible. And we will talk about the incredible, life-givingly beautiful, eye-opening, roll the windows down and turn the music up, progressive truth in Joshua in 2 weeks' time. But it's important that we talk about the problems with Joshua, because otherwise that truth that is so valuable and beautiful, in my opinion, falls flat or rings hollow. Because to get there, we have to acknowledge the death, the genocide, and the violence that are contained within the stories of the book of Joshua. So 2 weeks ago, we talked about the first problem with this book, and that was the moral problem with the thesis of Joshua. The moral problem is that God essentially promises all of Israel that as long as they're religious, then God in turn will slaughter all of Israel's enemies. This, of course, raises all sorts of questions, namely about the morality of God, and so we talked about that a few weeks ago. Then last week, we talked about the second problem with Joshua, which is the historical and archaeological problems contained within this book. All of modern archaeology suggests that the story of Joshua didn't actually happen as the book records. And in fact, it tells of a very peaceful time within Canaan's history. And so we're surprised to read a story about how violent and aggressive and filled with blood this period was, when archaeology says it was actually quite a peaceful time in Cana. So we talked about that last week, which was the second problem with Joshua. Which brings us to today, the third problem. And in order to talk about the third problem, we're going to highlight Joshua chapter 7. But before we get there, it's important for us to read something in chapter 6. Now, Joshua chapter 6 discusses Joshua in the Battle of Jericho. And it's at this battle that they march around the city one time every day for 6 days. And then on the seventh day, the Israelites march around the city of Jericho, not one, not two, but seven times. Then on the seventh time, Joshua turns to the Israelite army and says these words in verse 18. He says, "As for you, keep away from the things devoted to destruction, so as not to covet or take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel an object of destruction, bringing trouble upon it. But all silver and gold and vessels of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." So right before this assault begins on the city of Jericho, Joshua turns to the Israelites and says, "If you find any riches, any spoils, leave it. It belongs to the Lord." Then Joshua encourages all of Israel to raise a shout. They shout, they blast the horns, and the walls of Jericho come tumbling down. And then we read in Joshua 6:24 these words. The narrator says, "They burned down the city and everything in it. Only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord." In other words, Israel followed Joshua's instructions. So we assume everything went according to plan. After the Battle of Jericho, we turn the page into the seventh chapter of this book, and it's here that we read about a new story. So this new story is what we'll be talking about during this podcast. So the Battle of Ai begins by Joshua calling his spies together. He then tells them to go up and spy out the land in the neighborhood of Ai. So the spies go up to where Ai is, they spy on it, and they return to Joshua with some interesting intel. The first spy says, "It's a pretty small military in Ai, Joshua." The second spy says, "Only 2,000 or 3,000 should attack Ai." And the third person says, "Do not make the whole people toil up there." Now, if you're like me, you're reading this and you're thinking to yourself, "Wow, I must be a long ways away from Jericho." But when you look at a map, you realize that Ai is only about 25 miles away from Jericho. Now, Ai is up a significant incline, but it isn't that far away. So spies return to Joshua. They say, "Look, it's not a big deal. Just send a small battalion. It's a long hike up that hill. Let's just conquer Ai and then move on with it." So Joshua listens to his spies and decides to take their advice. He sends 3,000 troops up to take Ai and to conquer it in the name of Israel. So 3,000 soldiers begin the march up to Ai. And when these 3,000 troops arrive in Ai, they are ambushed and forced to retreat. And as they are retreating, 36 soldiers are killed in the Battle of Ai. And the remaining 2,900 troops return to Jericho, defeated and deflated. And we read in chapter 7, verse 5, this poetic line, "The hearts of the people of Israel melted and turned to water." In response to these 36 deaths, Joshua ripped his clothes, which was the Israelite sign of mourning. He then fell flat on his face and began to lament against God. His words toward God are this: "Ah, Lord God, why have you brought this people across the Jordan at all to hand us over to the Amorites so as to destroy us? Would that we had been content to settle beyond the Jordan. O Lord, what can I say now that Israel has turned their backs to their enemies? The Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it and surround us and cut off our name from the earth. Then what will you do, God, for your great name?" And then in this story, God speaks back to Joshua. God says, "Stand up, Joshua. Why have you fallen upon your face? Israel has sinned. They have transgressed my covenant that I imposed on them. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen. They have acted deceitfully, and they have put them among their own belongings. Therefore, the Israelites are unable to stand before their enemies. They turn their backs to their enemies because they have become a thing devoted for destruction themselves. I will be with you no more unless you destroy the devoted things from among you. Proceed to sanctify the people and say, 'Sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, there are devoted things among you, O Israel. You will be unable to stand before your enemies until you take away the devoted things from among you. In the morning, therefore,' God says, 'you shall come forward tribe by tribe. The tribe that the Lord takes shall come nearby clans. The clan that the Lord takes shall come nearby households. And the household that the Lord takes shall come nearby one. And the one who is taken as having the devoted things shall be burned with fire, together with all that he has, for having transgressed the covenant of the Lord and for having done an outrageous thing in Israel.'" So Joshua falls flat on his face and speaks to God, saying, "God, I wish you would have never brought us here. We are miserable. We are left to die here in the promised land. Why would you bring us across the Jordan, God," Joshua said, "and allow 36 soldiers to die?" And when God responds, God gives a rather strange answer, because God says to Joshua, "Don't put this on me." God says, "This is your fault, Joshua. Israel has sinned. The things that were set aside for the treasury of the Lord have been stolen from, and people took the spoils of war from Jericho for themselves. I had no choice but to allow these 36 soldiers to die because someone has kept the devoted things for themselves." So God lays out a plan for Joshua and tells him to separate the tribes of Israel, then pick one tribe, then one clan, then one family, and then one person. And that person is guilty of the deaths of these 36 soldiers. So the very next morning, Joshua gathers the 12 tribes of Israel. And according to the book of Joshua, we read that the tribe of Judah was taken. Now, I'm not sure what that means, but that's the way the author describes it. So the tribe of Judah was taken. And from the tribe of Judah, the clan of the Zerahites was taken from the tribe. Then from the clan of the Zerahites, the family of Zabdi was taken. And then from Zabdi, a man named Achan was taken from Zabdi. And it's here that Joshua confronts this one man who he believes has been singled out by God. And he says to Achan these words, "Tell me now what you have done. Do not hide it from me." Achan then confesses to the crime. He says, "It is true. I have sinned against the Lord God of Israel. This is what I did when I saw among the spoil a beautiful mantle from Shinar and 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold weighing 50 shekels. Then I coveted them and took them. They now lie hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath. So Joshua sent three men to go look in the tent of Achan. They went to the tent of Achan. They dug underneath the tent just as Achan had said, and they brought back with them the spoils of war that Achan described. We then read in verse 24, then Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, son of Zerah, with his silver, the mantle, and the bar of gold, with his sons and daughters, with his oxen, donkeys, and sheep, and his tent and all that he had, and they brought them up to the valley of Achor. And here at the valley of Achor, Joshua said to Achan, why did you bring trouble on us, Achan? The Lord is bringing trouble on you today. And all Israel stoned Achan to death. They burned Achan and his family with fire. They cast stones on them and raised over him a great heap of stones that remains to this day. And in verse 26, we read, then the Lord turned from his burning anger. Therefore, that place to this day is called the Valley of Achor, which is the Hebrew word for trouble. And that brings the story of Achan and chapter 7 to a close. Now, if you're like me, you hear the story of Achan, and you think to yourself something along these lines. This is a horrible story. It's just awful. I mean, it's tragic, it's nonsensical, it's violent. And when I read this story, I have to tell you, it just really grinds on me. And I get that it's in the Bible, and we're supposed to like all of the stories in the Bible, but when I read this story, I gotta tell you, I don't feel comfortable for a lot of reasons. And if someone were to ever ask me, hey, Craig, why is it that you don't like, or why do you find the story of Achan to be horrible? I would come back with three reasons why this is a horrible story. The first reason is this. If we go back to the previous chapter and we read about the Battle of Jericho, we read that verse that I've brought up before in this series, which is chapter 6, verse 21. The narrator tells us, then Israel devoted to destruction by the edge of the sword, all in the city of Jericho, both men and women, young and old, oxen, sheep, and donkeys. Now, this systemic destruction of everything that breathes is something that is vile and disgusting for our modern culture. However, it's important for us to acknowledge and understand that back in Joshua's day, this was actually a common practice. This common practice was known within the Hebrew language as a cherem. Now, the Hebrew word cherem means to have been utterly destroyed or appointed to utter destruction. And this idea that you kill everything that breathes of your enemies was how people preserved their tribal identity when conquering a new nation. So this violent practice of the cherem was something that the nation of Israel did in order to protect their tribal identities. Now, it's important that we read other people's literature, because if you were to read other ancient literature, we'd realize that the cherem was not exclusively practiced by the nation of Israel. In fact, the nation of Moab, which we talked about last week, which was a rival nation with Israel, Moab had the same practice, and they used the same word to describe the utter destruction of everything that breathed in your enemy's camp. They used the word cherem as well. And so the first definition of the Hebrew word is to have been utterly destroyed or appointed to utter destruction. But the word cherem can also mean a thing devoted, a thing dedicated, or devotion. And every time we read the word devoted in English in our Bibles today, it actually traces all the way back to the Hebrew word cherem. And so if you describe someone as devoted in ancient Israelite language, you would use the word cherem to describe him or her. So to practice this destruction of another nation was how one shows devotion to their current god. And so Israel says, we're going to go into Jericho and we're going to show our complete devotion to God by slaughtering every man, woman, and child in that city to show that we only trust ourselves and trust God, and we will practice the cherem. And the whole theology behind this word is that Israel is only as devoted as their weakest person within the camp. So if one person is only remotely devoted to God, then all of Israel is remotely devoted to God. So Israel marches into Jericho. They kill everything that breathes, and they're told that everything they see, every spoil of war, should be reserved for the treasury of the Lord. And one guy, a guy named Achan, decides to break this cherem, right? He's going to break this cherem because he sees something and he covets it, and so he takes it for himself. Now, according to Israelite theology, that means that all of Israel then isn't as devoted to God as they should be. And so when they find out about it, they respond by saying, oh, Achan has betrayed us as a nation. He is now a liability to our devotion to Yahweh. And so in response, they take Achan and they take everything that belongs to Achan, including Achan's family and livestock, and they kill Achan in order to practice the cherem internally and to show their renewed devotion to God. Now, that can all make sense on paper, but we're talking about people and Achan's children being slaughtered by stones. Why? Because Achan stole a few pieces of material from Jericho. So we can understand the reasoning behind Israel slaughtering Achan and his family, but that doesn't make it any better, does it? Now, it's important for us to establish that what Achan did was wrong. He stole something, and stealing is always wrong. And so he steals from the treasury of the Lord, and he goes through with this sin, and I have no qualms in saying what Achan did was wrong. That being said, the reason this story is horrible is because Achan's punishment does not fit Achan's crime. Achan being killed for stealing these things is an injustice. And when we read this story about Achan and his family being slaughtered because he stole something, we read it and we say this story is horrible because this is not justice. It is an injustice. And Achan's punishment does not fit Achan's crimes. And that is the first reason this story is a horrible story. The second reason this story is a horrible story is found at the very beginning of chapter 7. We hear about Joshua sending spies up to Ai. The spies return, and they give him the best intel they can. They tell him it's a pretty small military in Ai, and that only 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers should go and attack Ai. And another person says, please do not make the whole people toil up there. Joshua trusts the intel that's been given to him and sends 3,000 troops to Ai. As a result of that decision, 36 soldiers die. Now, it's easy for us to read historical numbers of casualties and be indifferent toward them. But when we're talking about 36 soldiers who died as a result of this decision, it's important for us to always remember that we are talking about 36 families whose lives will never be the same because of what Joshua decided. And when we look at how quickly Joshua made this decision and how quick he was to send those 3,000 troops up there kind of haphazardly and ignorantly, we realize that Joshua's carelessness leads to the death of 36 soldiers. Now, at this point, what does a mature leader do? Well, a mature leader then would accept responsibility for these deaths as a result of their decision, call the families of these soldiers that had fallen as a result of his decision, and personally apologize and make reprimands to make sure that they understand that this sacrifice these soldiers made was not given in vain. But instead, we get quite a different story, don't we? Joshua claims that God tells him that God is angry with Israel and it's not Joshua's fault. These 36 men did not die because of Joshua, but someone else in camp. And so Joshua returns after speaking with God and says, "These deaths are not my fault." He then points at a man named Achan and says, "You, these deaths are your fault." Now, according to the text, we read that Achan confesses to these crimes. But is Achan really at fault when it's Joshua's decision to send these 3,000 troops into Ai? I think the second reason I find this story so repulsive is the fact that Joshua is at fault for the death of 36 soldiers. And because Joshua is the leader and the commander in chief, he gets the glory and the credit when things go right, and he should therefore get the blame when things go wrong. But the second problem I have with this story is that Joshua is at fault for the death of 36 soldiers, yet he uses religion to place all of the blame on Achan. This is not what inspiring leaders do. And yet somehow Joshua gets away with it. And that is the second reason this story is a horrible story. Now, at this point, someone may point out, "Oh, but Craig, Israel was not as devoted to God as they should be. And so God had to allow those 36 soldiers to die in order to remind Israel they needed to be ultimately devoted to who God was." I understand that interpretation of the text, but here's the thing. When you look closely at the words of God and what God says to Joshua, the words that God says reveals a troubling truth about the character of God in this story. These words are found in verse 12. Shortly after, Joshua looks at the heavens and says, "I wish you would have never brought us here. Why did you bring us here to die? Why did these 36 soldiers have to die?" God responds by saying this to Joshua: "I will be with you and with Israel no more unless you destroy the devoted things from among you." God threatens to abandon God's people if they decide to hold on to these material possessions. God is willing to allow 36 soldiers to die unless Israel relinquishes silver and gold and a mantle. The third reason I find this story to be a horrible story is because in this story, God cares much more about things than people. God cares more about those three things that were stolen from Jericho than all of the 36 soldiers who died, and all of Achan and Achan's family, and even Achan's children. So in Joshua chapter 7, there are three reasons why this story is classified as a horrible story. The first reason is Achan's punishment does not fit Achan's crime. The second is that Joshua is at fault for the death of 36 soldiers, and yet he uses religion to place all of the blame on Achan. And the third reason is that God cares more about things than people. My brothers and my sisters, the story of Achan is a horrible story. And while we most often dismiss horrible stories and ask others to avoid them, or we do our best to ignore the horrible stories of the Bible, I have found that these stories can be some of our greatest teachers. The thing that this story teaches me is that religion can enable horrendous evil. Here we have a story of blame and injustice and children being slaughtered and God caring more about things than people. And it's all done in the name of religion. Religion is used to justify horrendous evil. And so this story of Achan raises all kinds of questions about what religion is in our personal life and in our life as a society. And I think the best thing that any of us can do as we read the story of Achan is to ask ourselves a simple question. What is religion? How would you answer that question? Maybe you consider yourself a religious person. What does that mean? If someone who considered themselves not to be a religious person came up and asked you, "What is religion?" how would you respond? Perhaps you consider yourself someone who is not religious. What does that mean? What are you not a part of? Because I've heard all sorts of definitions for what religion is, but I think something that is important for every religious person to answer is, what is religion? What is religion right now? And what should religion be? To help us answer the question, what is religion, I'd like to tell you the story of Becky Hammon. Now, Becky Hammon graduated from Colorado State University and aspired to play in the Women's National Basketball Association. Shortly after graduating, she entered the draft and was heartbroken to find that she went undrafted. She was told that she was too short and too slow to play professionally in the WNBA. Becky Hammon, though, decided that she was going to work hard. She worked as hard as she could and eventually became a walk-on on the New York Liberty and made the team. From there, she had an illustrious career. She played for 15 seasons, 7 with the New York Liberty and 7 with the San Antonio Stars. Toward the end of her career, she was hurt with a major injury and had to sit out for an entire year. Now, she did what most athletes did at this stage in her career. She began thinking about what would happen after she stopped playing in the WNBA. And she decided that one day she wanted to be a coach. And because she had this desire to be a coach in professional basketball, she wanted to learn from the best of the best. And because she was part of the San Antonio Stars, which are owned by the San Antonio Spurs of the NBA, she was able to have an appointment with Greg Popovich. And she went to him and said, "Greg Popovich, head coach of the San Antonio Spurs, I'd like to learn from you how to coach. I'm injured for the whole year and cannot play. Would you mind if I just sat in on your coaches' meetings and learned how to coach basketball from you?" Greg Popovich thought about this, and then after a few moments, he said, "Sure, you can come and sit in all of our coaches' meetings for this entire year." So Becky Hammon came and she sat in on all of these meetings. And after a few months, Greg Popovich would start to ask her questions. And as Greg Popovich tells the story, he says, "I all of a sudden realized I was dealing with a brilliant basketball mind." And so after she retired from the WNBA, Greg Popovich immediately hired her as an assistant coach for the San Antonio Spurs, where she is still employed to this day. Becky Hammon is the first female assistant coach ever hired in the National Basketball Association. Now, of course, the fragile male ego was threatened by this, and she was met with a wave of criticism. There were men who desired to coach in the NBA who saw her getting the position so easily, and they said, "Well, it's so much easier for her because she's a woman." She was criticized endlessly for getting this job. She was asked about this a few months into her first year as assistant coach for the Spurs, and she said these words. She said, "I think my story, just in general, is a story of someone who was overlooked. Someone who was told they can't. Someone who was told, 'You're too slow, you're too short. I've heard every reason why I shouldn't be successful, and yet you just take that all in. I always say you should be very careful with the voices you listen to, and my closest voices have always told me, you can." And as the years went by and people started to realize that it wasn't just a marketing hire, it started to make the patriarchy even more nervous. And one of New York's most famous sports radio hosts, a man named Mike Francesa, once received a caller last March in 2017. And this caller said, "Hey, I'm a dad. I've got a daughter, and my daughter's just really excited that she may one day coach in the NBA. And she loves Becky Hammon." And he then says to Mike Francesca on this call-in to this radio show, he says, "Mike, when do you think we'll see a female coach the NBA? Is this going to be in a few years or several years later?" And Mike Francesca responded by saying, "It's never going to happen. It's never going to happen." And he goes off on just a rant about how men would not listen to women the same way that men would listen to men. In fact, at one point, he said these words. He said, "If a female coach in the NBA ever happened, I don't think it would be anything more than a publicity stunt. I don't think it would last." I mean, this wasn't in 1957. This was 2017, may I remind you. Well, wouldn't you know it, just this last week, it was announced that the Milwaukee Bucks, who are looking for a head coach, have added Becky Hammon to their list of coaches they're going to interview. And Becky Hammon's accepted the interview, and so now she's just one step away from becoming the first female head coach in the NBA. Now, what's interesting is the local press in Milwaukee has heard about this potential female taking over their basketball team. And of course, because most of sports writing is dominated by men, they're not a big fan. A man named Gary D'Amato, who is the senior sports writer for the Milwaukee Sentinel Journal, wrote an article just on Friday, May 11, called "Time Not Right for Hammon to Coach Bucks." And in that article, he says, if it were solely about marketing, you could justify hiring her. In other words, she's just a gimmick. And if we just want to have a gimmick for a coach, that would work and you could justify hiring her. But if you want a coach who can coach basketball, Gary D'Amato says, please leave that to the men. Well, on that same day, there was another article published in the Players Tribune. And this article was titled "An Open Letter About Female Coaches," and it was written by a player named Pau Gasol. Now, Pau Gasol has won two titles with the Los Angeles Lakers and is currently on the San Antonio Spurs and under the tutelage of Becky Hammon. In this article, he writes, "Arguing on Coach Hammond's behalf would feel patronizing. Becky Hammon can coach NBA basketball, period." Now, if anybody were to ask Pau Gasol, how would you know that she can coach NBA basketball? I picture him saying, because she's coached me at NBA basketball. And then he goes on in the article to talk about all of the myths that people bring up that a female coach would present as a problem. And he dispels those myths one by one in a fantastic article. I highly recommend that you read it. And toward the end of this article, he starts talking about the larger work of the NBA and what's bigger than basketball and what really matters here on this earth. And during this closing paragraph, he uses the word "it" a lot to describe whatever it is. And so he writes these words in this article. Pau Gasol says, "I just think it's this beautiful thing, you know, to see the NBA begin to reflect the larger world. I think anytime you can expand your horizons towards something new and meaningful, it can only make you a better person. Which is also why I'm so encouraged to see the league taking the lead on so many important issues. I see it when we're coming together over something as urgent as Black Lives Matter. I see it when guys like DeMar DeRozan and Kevin Love are being vocal and open about emotional well-being. I see it when Adam Silver, our commissioner, is marching in an LGBTQ pride parade. I see it when MVPs like Steph Curry and LeBron James keep showing the world that nobody is too famous to use their platform to stand up for what they believe in. And of course, I see it when a franchise like the Bucks is willing to give an interview for their head coaching vacancy to a candidate who, male or female, absolutely deserves it." Now, if Pau Gasol were on this podcast, I would ask him this question. What is this "it" that you keep referring to? What is this "it" that you say is happening and that makes things beautiful and that is the action that brings value to life? Because whatever that "it" is exactly what did not happen at the Valley of Achor when a general blamed a civilian for the death of 36 soldiers. When God said, "Things are more important to me than people," that is definitely not when it happened. And yet Pau Gasol talks about this hopeful "it" when things change. What is this "it" that you are referring to, Pau Gasol? Fortunately for us, there is another man who referred to "it." And this man's name was Jesus Christ. Now, Christians profess that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And Jesus, in the shadow of the temple toward the end of his life, tells this story about "it" through a parable. And the story goes like this. Jesus says to his disciples, "When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne of glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep on his right hand and the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those on his right hand, 'Come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. And I was in prison and you visited me. Then the righteous will answer Jesus, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you? And the king will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me. If Jesus were here with us on this podcast, I would ask him this question. What is this it that you keep referring to? Because whatever that it is did not happen at the Valley of Achor. Achan and religion and whatever Joshua used to place this blame on this man was not the it that Jesus described or Pau Gasol describes. Instead, Jesus says, whenever you did it, whenever you did this thing, and it to Jesus is whenever people who are in need are met with compassion. Whenever people who are hurting are met with healing. Whenever people who are lonely are given companionship. And Jesus even describes this it as the kingdom of heaven who is written into the foundation of the world. That is what it is. And Jesus describes this thing, this substance that makes life worth living, that it's the thing that we should strive toward, as being bigger than any religion could ever contain by itself. Here, there are people who look around in this story and they look at each other and they say, how do we know this God? And God says, all you simply had to do was take care of those who were in need. Because when I read Pau Gasol and I read what Jesus is talking about in this parable, it is a brand new way of living. And Jesus refers to it as the kingdom of heaven. Pau Gasol, who I do not believe is religious, refers to it probably as a better humanity. But at the end of the day, they're talking about the same thing. If a Buddhist began writing about it, she would talk about nirvana. And we all have these different languages to describe whatever this it is. And it's all these religions trying to pull and push toward the same thing that we know religion should be. And so when you look at this question, which is what is religion? It's important to ask, well, where does this lead if it's true? And how does this apply to not just my religion, but to other religions as well? And so whenever you define this term that is religion, I would encourage you to see if it lines up with Jesus Christ and the parable, the sheep and the goats, and Pau Gasol and what he writes about, Becky Hammon possibly becoming the first female coach in the NBA. Or does it line up with the Valley of Achor? And could this definition of religion be used to justify horrendous evil? And if that's the case, and it can be used to justify that, then I would encourage all of us to get a new definition of religion. And when you can define what religion is, then you can start to understand how it plays in one's life or in one's society and why it's valuable. So my brothers and sisters, it's important for all of us to define what religion is. And I'd like to close by sharing with you my definition of religion. Now, when I share a definition of religion with you, it's not that you'll have the same definition as me. But you can look at it, you can think about it, and you may reject it, and that's fine. But it's just been helpful to me to define religion this way, and I hope it can be helpful to you. Because when somebody asks me the question, what is religion? I believe that healthy religion is the practice of becoming fully human. Healthy religion is the practice of becoming fully human. And when I read Jesus's parable in Matthew 25, the undergirding truth of that story is the importance of compassion. and there are few things more humane than the practice of compassion, isn't there? When you think about what really separates us as human beings from the other things on this planet, it is our ability to empathize and weep with others and to suffer alongside and to bring hope to the hopeless. And these things are all hard things to do. And there's times that we go in the wrong direction and we have to apologize, own how we made mistakes, and then turn in the opposite direction. That's why it's the imperfect practice of becoming fully human. So, my brothers and sisters, may we have the courage to examine what religion is within our lives and our societies. May we read the story of Achan and realize how religion can be very problematic in people's lives and hold up a mirror to ourselves and ask, how is my religion hurting others and what needs to change about it? And may we have the courage to see and embrace the inspiration of Jesus Christ in all.